It's 4 o'clock, time once again for Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. Last Sunday, poet and novelist Bob Morgan was in town, and I had a chance to sit down with him after his reading at Malaprops and talk about his new book, Boone. Today, we're going to hear some excerpts from that interview. Well, how did you come to Boone?
Well, in a sense, I've always been interested in Boone. I grew up in the Blue Ridge Mountains here in Henderson County, and ran in the woods and hunted and fished and trapped when I was young. And my dad was a kind of Daniel Boone himself. He loved to hunt and tramp in the woods, and somewhat like Daniel Boone, he never really made any money. His business ventures were mostly failures. And like Daniel Boone, he didn't much care.
Right.
He was happy to go on with things, whether he had any money or not. But as a kid growing up on that farm, and out plowing or hoeing corn, you would turn over arrowheads and pieces of pottery. And it seemed to me, even as a kid, that the ground was haunted by the Indians. And I knew the streams had Indian names, and the river seemed to be whispering in a ghostly way, and the waterfalls seemed to be shouting in the distance. And it was as though the Indians were still there, almost. You just couldn't see them. So from my earliest memory, I was very interested in what we now call Native Americans, in this case mostly Cherokees, at least in the last 500 years in western North Carolina. And if you are interested in the meeting of the Europeans and the Indians, particularly in this region, Daniel Boone is one of the key figures because he hunted with the Indians, he studied them, he was as good a hunter as they were, as good a tracker. He could slip into Cherokee land when he wanted to and extract the furs, and was sometimes caught by them and robbed, but he took it cheerfully and would pass his flask around and call them his brothers, and actually saved his scalp and lived much longer than most hunters did as a result. They liked him. He had
a good attitude.
He had a good personality. But I had two main questions in mind when I started the project. One, I wanted to find out why Daniel Boone, among hundreds, if not thousands, of frontiersmen, hunters, woodsmen, that was the term he preferred. He was a woodsman. Mm-hmm. Why he became so famous in his own lifetime, and most of the other hunters are forgotten. Right. What was it about Daniel Boone that made him so famous? By the time he was 50, he was known in Europe and Britain, as well as North America.
Yeah.
And the second question was, is it possible to peel away the folklore, the mythology, all the legends, get behind the Fess Parker TV series and the Walt Disney movies and find a living, breathing human being that we in the 21st century can understand, even though he's in the 18th century?
Yeah.
That was the big challenge for me. And in answer to the first question, I began to discover that one of the origins of the legend of Boone was Boone himself. He was just such a good storyteller.
A raconteur.
A great raconteur. He would come back from his long hunts and describe what he had seen, the Indians he had encountered. He was also a great prankster. He loved to tell jokes. He laughed so much that the Cherokees named him Widemouth. They were real poets. They always found the right name for something. And, of course, the second thing that made him internationally famous was Filson's Adventures of Colonel Daniel Boone, a little essay that purports to be autobiography and is quite obviously a collaboration between Boone and Filson, published in 1784 just as he turned 50, and later published in Europe and translated into German and French
a big international,
pirated. It really became internationally famous. It's a classic. Boone himself would tell people later that it's true, every word of it true.
Every word, yes.
And we know that it was the way he wanted to be seen and to be remembered, as somebody who had set off to Kentucky in quest of the country of Kentucky.
Yeah.
And as far as I can tell, there's only one mistake in it, and that is a mistaken date of when he went into Kentucky in June of 1774. That he went in... I guess earlier than it says in that. Uh-huh. But except for that, it as far as modern scholars can find, it is absolutely true.
Yeah, yeah. I think Boone becomes a figure for the Romantics in England.
This happened first because a scoundrel, a true scoundrel, named Gilbert Imlay, cheated Boone out of 10,000 acres of prime bluegrass land in Kentucky. Never paid him a cent for it. Imlay escaped ahead of his creditors in lawsuits to Britain and formed a relationship with Mary Wollstonecraft, a great feminist.
Right.
Fathered her first child, Fanny.
Really?
And through her met many of the English literary people, including William Godwin, future husband of Mary Wollstonecraft, and the father of Mary Shelley. But through them, he was in contact with the people who became the Romantics, and he published Filson's essay under his own name with a very few changes. Oh, he was a real crook.
He was, yeah.
And that made Boone extremely famous in Britain in the 1790s. The book was translated into French and then
Germans and so on.
Of course, Romanticism was sweeping through Europe. Later, the American Romantics were equally influenced, but in a more implicit way. The figure of Boone as the great self-reliant man of the frontier, the man of nature, the man who can live in harmony with nature, in harmony with the Indians, became embedded so deeply in the Americans' idea of themselves, that Boone was inspiring people, though not by name. He was the original. So that when you read Emerson on self-reliance, you read Thoreau on solitude, it's quite clear they're referring to this type as the ideal, the romantic ideal, though they don't name Boone. They don't need to. I mean, this has been established as a romantic ideal deriving from Boone decades earlier.
Right. He was already, by that time, an iconic figure.
So when Thoreau is describing, you know, the poetry of the wilderness and the poetry of solitude, he is putting into these finely wrought sentences the experience that Boone lived. Boone lived the poem of the wilderness, and they're writing it, essentially. When Whitman is writing about the open road, the life of freedom, the life of brotherhood, his ideal is somebody like Boone who can go out and be a brother to the Indians and a brother to the other hunters, absolutely free, striking off into the West. And, of course, Boone is a major figure in this romanticism about westering. I've already said Boone, you know, described his quest for the country of Kentucky as though he's a knight, as though he's going, you know, on some high mission. Felix Walker, who was from North Carolina and helped hack the Wilderness Road with Boone in 1775, was wounded by Indians and was carried in a litter over the hills down to Boonesboro, what became Boonesboro. And he said, when we came over the ridge and looked down to the meadow, and we saw 300 buffalo splashing across the river that had been spooked by us when they appeared.
Wow.
And we knew we were seeing a world that was about to disappear.
Yeah.
A paradise that was about to disappear. He said, we felt we were entering an Elysium where there was no forbidden fruit.
But they had a paradoxical relationship to it, it sounds. They were aware that it was vanishing and that their presence accelerated in some ways its disappearance.
Well, as I said, Boone turned out to be, as I studied him, a very complex man.
Yeah.
He's not at all the simple frontiersman of folklore and the films. An example of that complexity is that from his childhood, he was drawn to hunting, to the solitude of the forest, to living on his own, this exhilarating experience of nature, pristine nature that he loved so much. At the same time, when he was back in the settlements, he was very popular socially. He was a great storyteller. He always had a great circle of friends. His family held him in great affection. Later, when he was married, he was a devoted family man, and his family admired him and looked up to him. And then he could disappear into the wilderness again and be gone for months and even sometimes years.
Yeah, he spent,
and come back and yeah. be the charismatic leader and figure. Everybody turned to him. He seemed to be the authority figure among most of the groups that he belonged to, like Washington. When things started happening, everybody turned to him. When the arrows were flying at a fort, the bullets were flying. Even if he was outranked by other men, everybody turned to Boone to know what to do. And the great paradox of his life is that because of his great love of the wilderness, he went there, and because of his charisma and his fame, he led many others to go there and destroy it. And I think that in some ways that paradox really is the paradox of American history and American culture, that we tend to destroy what we love most. We destroy the environment not because we hate it, but because we love it. And it's in conflict with other loyalties and other passions we have toward development, toward commerce, toward power. And Boone was described in 1784 by Filson as the instrument of the settlement of the West. This was the label he carried with him in his years of fame. And he said to an interviewer toward the end of his life, "I know I have been the instrument of the destruction of the Indians' hunting ground." He saw every wilderness he had enjoyed destroyed in his own lifetime. The wilderness in Pennsylvania, where he was born, the wilderness in western North Carolina, the wilderness of Kentucky, the wilderness of western Virginia, and of Missouri. By the time he died, Missouri was heavily settled, and the Indian natives there were pretty much gone.
A fascinating bit of American history, indeed. It's 103.5 WPVM. You're listening to Wordplay out of Asheville, North Carolina. It's a little Al Petaway from his CD, Whispering Stones. Now back to Bob Morgan. Why don't you read a little bit from your book on Daniel Boone?
Well, I will read a short passage from early in the book about his childhood. Everybody who talked about Boone just about described him as different. He seemed different from other people. Yeah. There was a difference. And when he was a boy, his family thought of him as different. There's a famous anecdote that he wouldn't go to school, and the uncle, who was a school teacher, said to his father, Squire, "If Sarah, the mother, would let me whip that boy, I could teach him to spell." And Squire, the father, said, "Well, let's let the girls do the spelling and Daniel do the hunting. And between you and me, that's what we need most." But he was very close to his mother. And when his father bought 25 acres of land out in the wilderness, Daniel would go with her there to look after the cattle and sheep that were pastured there. Now, this is a couple of paragraphs from early in the book. Daniel's closest relationship was with his mother, tall, Welsh Sarah, with her black eyes and cheerful disposition. From his birth, she seemed to favor Daniel of all her children, tolerating his pranks, his tendency to slip away into the woods for hours, for whole days. The bond between mother and son was intense, affectionate, inspiring. It seems she put her fondest hopes in this independent, sometimes wayward boy, driven by enthusiasms for the wild and curiosity about the world beyond the farm, beyond the river. In October of 1744, Squire Boone bought 25 acres of land 5 miles north of his home in Olay. That was where he pastured livestock, and from the age of 10, Daniel accompanied Sarah there in the summer to look after the cattle and sheep. From spring until fall, he lived with her in a cabin in the woods. For the rest of his life, Daniel would look back on those summers as an idyllic time. He was assigned to keep an eye on the herds and help with the cows while his mother milked and made butter and cheese. Once a week, they carried the milk and milk products on foot back to the homestead. For Daniel, the father, the forest was his mother world, a place of shadows and mystery, infinite diversions and pleasure. The settlement and town were the masculine world of trade and business, meeting house, authority, and strictness. He would always be closer to the mother world than the father world. His deepest affinity was with the forest and the streams, and he delighted in solitude. Well, when Daniel was about 17, his family moved from Pennsylvania, first to Virginia, down the Great Wagon Road, which is the main route of migration, mm-hmm. to the Yadkin Valley in North Carolina, which was the new frontier.
Right.
They were always moving, he was always moving to the frontier. His father had been expelled from the Quaker meeting there because one of his children married outside the Quaker faith, and Squire, the father, refused to apologize. He had apologized before when another child had done that. And it's very likely at that time Squire Boone became a Freemason. That was the new thing, the new fresh wind sweeping through this sense of brotherhood and charitable works, nothing to do with class, with feudalism, and with the old structure of society. It was a part of the revolutionary movement.
Right, it was a liberation from that, in fact.
In both North America and in France, it contributed. Boone, as a teenager and then as a young man in his 20s, began to hunt further and further into the Blue Ridge Mountains from their home on the Yadkin, always going to the west, further to the west, going finally over the mountains into the westward flowing waters of the Watauga River and the New River, and over toward what became Tennessee, the Holston Valley, Tennessee Valley. But in 1755, he had belonged to the militia serving under Washington on the way to Braddock's defeat in the French and Indian War. And by the campfires, as they went on that that expedition, he met a man named John Finlay, who had gone down the Ohio River and traded with the Indians at the Falls of the Ohio, what became Louisville. And Finley told Boone of this paradise across the mountains, the cane lands, the clover, the bluegrass, the buffalo herds, the elk, the beavers. And there were no Indian villages there. It just seemed like a paradise for the taking. And from that time on, Boone began to dream of crossing the mountains and going to this promised land of Kentucky. But it was so far away, and it was so dangerous to get there, and it was so expensive to outfit a big expedition to go that far into the wilderness, that it took him 14 years to actually reach the bluegrass. So he did not go through Cumberland Gap until 1769, when Finley came to North Carolina, and together they outfitted an expedition, probably with the support of Judge Richard Henderson of Salisbury, who was hiring Boone to explore Kentucky with an eye toward buying it from the Indians. Henderson had this great idea that he would found his own colony across the mountains. He would buy Kentucky, he would call it Transylvania,
and
rule it as a lord proprietor. but he also had a number of backers. He formed a company called the Transylvania Company. Eventually, Boone got to lead people in 1775 to Cumberland Gap on that expedition. And the second passage I'll read to you is about the importance of the Kentucky River Valley and the Ohio River Valley to the people who dreamed of getting to the West. It was what Washington was interested in, and Patrick Henry and Jefferson and the governors of the colonies, and the King of England, for that matter.
Everyone was interested.
Everybody wanted Kentucky.
Kentucky.
And this is the first two paragraphs of a chapter called Kentucky Was the Key. It's easy to forget in the 21st century the significance for the English-speaking Eastern communities of the settling and holding of Kentucky. The bluegrass region was valuable in itself almost beyond description, as a place to claim and build farms and towns and future cities and great wealth. explorers and speculators and leaders of the time understood that a foothold in Kentucky served as a buffer against the Indians, against the British to the north, and perhaps the Spanish to the west and south. But even more than that, a settled Kentucky promised to open the whole Ohio Valley for settlement. Some Indians seemed to grasp this threat implicitly and fought with tenacity and courage and imagination the forts and stations, the farmers and surveyors in the great meadow. They seemed to perceive from the first that once their buffalo hunting grounds and the bluegrass were claimed and cleared, the land north of the Ohio would be next. Other native leaders, such as Cornstalk of the Shawnees, were willing at first to accommodate the English settlers and did not foresee an inexorable tidal wave of westward expansion. For the whites, nothing could have been more exhilarating, more intoxicating than the taking and keeping of land across the barrier of mountains. For once that hurdle was finally surpassed, after 150 years of hesitating and yearning in the east, the great river valleys of the central continent would be within reach. Filson described Kentucky as the best tract of land in North America, and probably in the world. The Ohio Valley was more beautiful and contained more land than anyone had mapped or measured. And beyond lay the Illinois country, the fertile Mississippi Valley, stretching almost to Canada in the north and to New Orleans in the south. And beyond the Mississippi, reports were heard of an even bigger river valley, the Missouri, that reached far into a mythical west, and whispered rumors of mountains so high their tips sparkled with snow in July. But whatever lay beyond, in the sunlit pastures and hills of coming years, Kentucky was the key, the first west. Kentucky was the threshold, the beachhead to who knew what playlands and empires of the future farther west. Now, Boone led all those people to settle the bluegrass region of Kentucky, mm-hmm. and actually other regions of Kentucky. And at one time he owned about 30,000 acres of land, mm. and he made an enormous amount of money as a surveyor. He became a licensed surveyor and mm-hmm. was actually a rather good surveyor. Most historians say he got in trouble because he was a bad surveyor. This is not true. He got in trouble because he did not always do the paperwork thoroughly. And he was not aggressive in following through to defend his claims. Uh-huh. If somebody challenged him in court, he would just give over the claim and go on and, you know, find another claim. He hated trouble. He hated fighting. And he hated court.
Right.
As I say, that was the father world, the court.
Right.
And what he loved was the mother world of the forest. Mm-hmm. Boone was squeezed out, and in 1799 he left Kentucky and cut down a huge poplar tree and made a dugout 50 feet long and 5 feet wide to carry all his belongings and his wife and many of their children and grandchildren.
Yeah.
And he and his sons and friends drove a herd of cattle, horses, and hogs overland, crossing rivers on ferries, to Missouri, where the Spanish government had given him a huge tract of land and land for everybody who came with him, and they made him the administrator of the district.
So Missouri was still Spanish territory at that time?
It was at that time Spanish territory, which quickly returned to the French as a part of a settlement between those two countries. And the French treated him very well. They honored all the commitments the Spanish had made to him. And in fact, the Spanish administrators were Frenchmen who had been there when the Spanish took it over.
And they just retained them.
Yeah, they retained. So if you go out to the Missouri Historical Society, I mean, they will bring you all the documents, the deeds written out in French to Monsieur Daniel Boone. I mean, the original documents, the, you know, Le Gouverneur de l'Issue, you know, writing to the great Daniel Boone.
Yeah.
Giving him those tracts of land and his authority to administer the district. Well, the last passage I'll read is from later in his life. He loved Missouri. It was still wilderness when he went there. There were still Indians.
Yeah.
He could hunt with his Shawnee relatives and other people up the Missouri, paddle up the Missouri. go on the Gasconade River, and sometimes they go all the way up to what became Kansas and then to Iowa. And the legend is, and apparently it is true, that he and a large group of friends went all the way up to the Yellowstone.
Wow.
And came back with a keelboat loaded with beaver skins.
Wow.
A fortune in beaver skins.
Yeah.
Very late in his life. His favorite hunting companion in Missouri was a slave named Derry Coburn, who belonged to his son, Daniel Morgan. And Daniel and Derry hunted again and again in the wilderness up the river, Missouri. They knew each other so well, they didn't have to speak. They would go days without actually saying a word because they understood, you know, what they needed to do. And,
right.
And, of course, it's very good to keep silent if you're hunting, if you're out in the wilderness, where there might be not only wild animals, but Indians
as well. Yeah.
Prowling. But once, when he was about 80 years old, he was out there hunting, and he got very sick. And Derry Coburn went back to the settlement to tell his son that his father was very ill. And Nathan, assuming his father had died, because he was quite old, he was 80, ordered a coffin to be built, and he went after the body of his father. But Boone had not died. In fact, he had rallied and was able to return with Nathan. And when he saw the coffin Nathan had ordered, Boone was not at all pleased. Made of plain boards, it was, quote, too rough and uncouth. For all his modesty and good manners, Boone had a sense of style and dignity. Plain coffin was used for a relative, and Boone ordered a fine coffin made for himself to match the one he had commissioned for Rebecca in 1813. Quote, soon after this event, he gave directions to a cabinet maker in the settlements to prepare a coffin of black walnut for himself, which was done accordingly and was kept in his dwelling for several years, John Mason Peck would write. But according to Peck, Boone later decided the walnut coffin was not good enough either. He gave that coffin for someone else's burial and ordered an even better one for himself. Quote, another of cherry was prepared and placed under his bed, where it continued until it received his mortal remains. The cherry coffin was a handsome piece of work, and the old man took pleasure in showing it off. Elizabeth Corbin, sister of Daniel Morgan Boone's wife Sarah, later told Draper, the coffin appeared marvelously beautiful. The fame of it spread among the simple-minded settlers, and it had exceedingly numerous visitors. Later, the coffin was stored in Nathan's new stone house, but from time to time, Boone would take it out to admire and study. His granddaughter, Delinda, later remembered that he would rub and polish it up and coolly whistle while doing it. Others said he would lie down in the coffin to show how well it fit him, and sometimes he would take a nap in it, scaring the children.
A sense of humor to the end.
He always had a sense of humor. I found that story in a history of Missouri pioneers published in 1840. And it was too good to pass up.
Really? Oh. Well, Bob, thanks so much for coming in today and sharing your book, Boone. And it's just out, so people should run out and buy it at their bookstores.
Well, it's good to talk to you. I've enjoyed it.
Well, great, great. Yeah, good to see you again. We've been listening to Bob Morgan reading from Boone, his new biography of Daniel Boone, and talking about the work and about Boone. Thanks so much for joining us. Be sure and check WPVM.org, our website, for rebroadcast schedule and other pertinent information, including this program, which is available 24/7 from the archive page as either a stream or a podcast. See you next week.